go ahead and get started here. We're maybe a minute early, but we'll get started. I've probably met most of you, but if I haven't, my name is John Aloisi, and I teach church history at the seminary. And you can see from our workshop title, The Great Century of Christian Missions, British Efforts to Reach the World for Christ. You can see we're focusing on British efforts during the Great Century. That's not to say that Americans were not involved or people from other places. In fact, Americans like Adoniram and Ann Judson would be contemporaries of William Carey, who we will talk about. But the British were first in the Great Century. In fact, Carey was about 20 years before Judson would set sail. He was in India. And so we also just don't have time to talk about American efforts during that. We'd kind of need a second workshop. That could really be a separate workshop. So we'll be talking about British efforts during the 1800s mostly. I'm going to largely read the notes, make comments here and there, and we'll skip over some sections. Some of you commented that it's kind of thick here. We'll skip over a few paragraphs here and there. Probably need to do that for the sake of time. If you have questions along the way, you're welcome to interrupt, so go ahead and do that. I might repeat your question because this is being recorded, but if you have a question along the way, go right ahead. Yes, thank you. In the 1940s, Kenneth Scott Latouret popularized the phrase the Great Century of Christian Missions as a term to describe the flurry of missionary activity that took place during the long 19th century, roughly 1792 to 1910. Latouret wrote a 7-volume work. I can't prove that he coined the term Great Century, but as he wrote this 7-volume work on the scope of church history from the Book of Acts up until the early 20th century, 3 of the 7 volumes were actually on the 1800s. So he spent nearly half the work talking about the Great Century. See the dates there, 1792, that's when William Carey penned, he wrote a little tract called An Enquiry into the Obligation of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathen. And Carey would set sail the next year, 1793, for India. 1910 there is the date of the Edinburgh Missionary Conference, which met in Scotland with John Mott as the chair. It was really a turning point in missions efforts, a move in the direction of ecumenical efforts at missions. In fact, Mark Knoll in his book Turning Points lists it as one of the 12 turning points in church history. So 1910. Although the Great Century was a time of remarkable missionary advance, ever since the first century, Christians had been engaged in missions, and more specifically, British Protestants were involved in missions through the 1600s and 1700s. For example, the Company for the Propagation of the Gospel in New England and parts adjacent, they liked long names in those days, that group, society, was founded by an act of British Parliament in 1649 for the purpose of converting native Indians in the New England colonies to Christianity. Incidentally, after the Revolutionary War, they would start focusing on other parts of the world outside North America. But British Parliament themselves set aside, established a missions agency to try to reach Indians, at least professedly. As well, throughout the 1600s, men like John Eliot served as missionaries to the American Indians. Other organizations like the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge and the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts were formed right around the turn of the century, right around the year 1700. So we're still 100 years before Carey or so, and a number of different mission agencies were being formed. As well, during the 1700s, the Moravians especially launched what some see as the first great wave of Protestant missionary work. However, having said that, the 1800s would be unique, would be different. It would see efforts unlike those that had been seen in the previous centuries. And so it's rightly called the Great Century of Christian Missions. If you think about the time frame of the Great Century, things changed a lot. I mean, George Washington was in his first term as president, 1792. I mean, we were a very young nation, just having broken free from Britain. By the end, we were on the eve of the Great War, World War I. The Titanic was about ready to sink. They were about ready to launch it. It wasn't ready to sink, but it would sink just a couple years later. The Great War would start. So things changed a lot. 1792, trains weren't in use. By 1910, Henry Ford was selling more than 10,000 cars a year. So things just changed a lot during this 120 years or so that we call the Great Century of Christian Missions. But why do we call this the Great Century? And why did missionary effort thrive during the 19th century? Well, I have here a list of some reasons, some factors that I think encouraged missions during the 1800s. First there, the previous century, the 1700s, was an age of global exploration. Through the published records of his three voyages, Captain James Cook inspired more than a few Englishmen to head to sea in search of adventure. In addition to inspiring both adventure-seeking young men and mature scientists who wanted to see some of the things that Cook had seen, Cook also informed British Christians about what lay beyond the borders of so-called Christian Europe. And such information encouraged some believers to seek means to evangelize the unreached peoples described in Cook's journals. Though, if you look at the map on the previous page, Cook didn't actually make it to India, where Carey would end up going. So people also went to other places, places that Cook never did describe. On the eve of the 19th century, the French Revolution effectively cut the purse strings of Roman Catholic missionary activity. Through the 1700s, Roman Catholics were fairly active in missionary work, but at the end of the century, the real powerhouse, financial powerhouse of the Roman Catholic Church at the time went through the French Revolution. And Napoleon's troublemaking, so to speak, throughout the Mediterranean, which lasted into the early 1800s, around 1815, really prevented Roman Catholics from heading out to sea in search of new lands to try to convert to Roman Catholicism. And so missionary activity on behalf of the Roman Catholic Church was pretty much curtailed at the end of the 1700s and into the early 1800s. Seems like Protestants sensed a vacuum that could be filled by missionaries preaching the true gospel. So, well, near the end of the 18th century, post-Reformation scholasticism was displaced by a stronger emphasis on putting ideas into practice. People like to bat around theories and ideas and talk. Sometimes this happens, say, in college dorms or whatever. People speculate about all kinds of things. In the academic world, people had been speculating and doing a lot of academic work in the area of theology. But as we come to the end of the 1700s, there was really a strong push toward, let's do something. Let's not just talk about theories, talk about our ideas. Let's put these ideas into practice. And that would certainly take place as Christians began to be more engaged in missions. Layer D there, European colonization, had recently opened up many new areas as potential missionary fields. British missionaries often had a love-hate relationship with British imperialism and aggressive British trade. But the reality is that British colonialism and institutions like the East India Company made it much more feasible for British missionaries to travel to India and other distant lands. As the British flag kind of moved around the globe, missionaries frequently followed. And now sometimes it was more difficult. Sometimes the East India Company and other trade organizations made things difficult for the missionaries, set a bad precedent, whatever. But they did create a certain sense of safety. And one wasn't simply going out into the wilderness. One was going someplace where the British were established, and there was a familiarity there, a sense of safety. And so sometimes the early missionaries seemed to follow the British flag around the globe. Letter E there, the concepts of individual liberty and individual responsibility were becoming politically popular, and these emphases were soon reflected in many churches. This resulted in people accepting personal responsibility to evangelize among the nations. It isn't just something for people out there or for the church in general. I'm responsible in my church, and, oh, I'm responsible for the Great Commission. And so people began to think that way increasingly in the churches. Letter F there, the revivals of the 1700s laid a firm foundation for Christian commitment to actively serve Christ. Think of the Great Awakening of the 1730s and 40s, and then what some call the Second Great Awakening right around the turn of the century, right around 1800. Laterette said, never before had Christianity or any other religion had so many individuals giving full time to the propagation of the faith. Never had so many hundreds of thousands contributed voluntarily of their means to assist the spread of Christianity or any other religion. And so right about the end of the 1700s, Christians were more willing to give of their resources, give of their sons, to go into missionary labor. During the late 1700s and early 1800s, Protestantism was thriving, while many non-Christian religions were experiencing a period of decline. For example, it's hard to get accurate numbers about Muslims. It's a little easier today, but certainly in the past, to know how many Muslims existed, say, in the year 1800. The numbers are just very hard to come by in an accurate way. But we do know that certain things were taking place, such as Napoleon's conquest of Syria and Egypt right around the turn of the century, which took back, at least for a time, conquered areas that were predominantly Muslim. And that kind of thing was taking place right around the turn of the century, late 1700s and into the early 1800s. Letter H, missions was in the air. Numerous Christian leaders had been pushing for missionary activity in the decades leading up to the 1790s. Many pastors were pushing for greater involvement in missions. For example, during the mid-1700s, men like Jonathan Edwards had urged believers to be more active in prayer and more involved in reaching the lost. Edwards' work, The Life and Diary of David Brainerd, which perhaps some of you have read, published in the mid-18th century, set Brainerd forth as a great example of sacrifice for the sake of the gospel. And we probably shouldn't underestimate the power of positive examples. Just like as a side, say for young people today, the power of putting examples before them, encouraging them to read missionary biographies. If their great heroes are all athletes, in all likelihood, you're going to raise up a lot of athletes. If their heroes are missionaries, God works in the hearts of individuals, but all other things being equal, if their heroes are missionaries, they're much more likely to look toward the mission field. And certainly, people like Jonathan Edwards were putting men like Brainerd out before believers, saying, this is something to be imitated, this kind of commitment to reaching the lost with the gospel. And then last year, I put this last, but this is certainly not least, God providentially was stirring up his people to obey the Great Commission. And he made it possible for them to do so. He made them it possible for people to get to areas that were previously much harder to reach. By means of technology, we think of technology as like phones and stuff, but ship technology, the ability to explore and travel, certainly was increasing about this time, and God was giving people a desire to do what he was also enabling them to do by means of progress and such in general society. Let's talk about some of the British Baptist missionaries and their supporters. We'll start by talking about Baptists, then we'll move on to talk about some who are not Baptists. Andrew Fuller first, his early life and ministry, was born in Cambridgeshire, England, to a farming family of particular Baptists. He was a huge man who, before his conversion, was a wrestler. He would later be called, as you see there in the picture, the Elephant of Kettering, which may be a reference to his size. It's not known how he was given the nickname. It might have been his influence, but I'm inclined to think it was his physical size as a large man. He was converted and baptized at Soham in 1770 at the age of 16. At the age of 20, he was ordained and became pastor of the church there, where he remained for 7 years. He then moved in 1783 to Kettering, where he pastored the Baptist church there for 32 years. And during this time, for more than 20 years, he also served as secretary of the Baptist Missionary Society. When you think secretary in this context, don't think a lady who types letters and answers the phone. He's very much the director of this mission society. He's the main guy who corresponds with the missionaries and makes policy decisions and things like that. So he's very much the leader of the mission society. His contribution to missions as a self-educated but influential writer, Fuller was the practical theologian of particular Baptists at the end of the 18th century. His most famous work was The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, in which he argued for an all-sufficient atonement and for duty faith, the idea that you are responsible to believe whether or not you believe you're elect. There were some among the hyper-Calvinists who were saying that a person is not actually responsible to believe unless they already know that God has elected them. After all, they can't believe unless they're elect, so if they're not elect, they're not really responsible, which was actually almost a side similar to Arminianism in some ways. If you can't, you're not responsible. And Fuller pushed back against that and argued for duty faith, argued for a view of the atonement that encouraged some to travel and preach the gospel to those who had never heard of the cross. Hyper-Calvinists criticized the new theological movement of preaching the gospel to all men and the duty of all men to believe as Fullerism. Again, some of these hyper-Calvinists didn't think that people should be compelling others to believe, should be urging the gospel upon people if they didn't know they were elect. So if I don't know if you gentlemen in the front row are elect, I'm not going to call on you to turn to Christ because you can't. And you're not ultimately responsible if you're not among the elect. And Fuller was pushing back against that, saying, no, we have a responsibility to preach the free gospel to all. Yes, he was a particular Baptist. Yes, he believed God had chosen some before the foundation of the world. But he said it was the responsibility of all to honor their Creator and his Son. His book, The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, provide a strong theological impetus for evangelism and missions. A person doesn't have to agree with every element of Fuller's theology to recognize that it was influential and helpful to many in the late 1700s, early 1800s. I don't actually agree with Fuller on a number of issues, but recognize his contribution. Here's some of the principles that Fuller kind of put in place concerning missions administration. How should missions be done? And from his perspective, staying in England, he had a desire to go but never did go to the foreign field. He stayed in England. How should missions be directed and accomplished? He said that missionaries should not hold offices in local churches. So as much as possible, churches should be turned over to converted, trained locals, natives who are able to lead the churches themselves. He said believers should set aside personal differences and work together for the good of the mission. So cooperation, even when there are some differences among missionaries. On page 4, missionaries should never meddle in politics. That would really get tried in India with some of the things going on and certainly British involvement, things such as burning of widows, things like that that Kerry would end up speaking out against. Yet missionaries shouldn't try to go there and fix the political system, fix the economic system in the mission field. There, missionaries must never waver from New Testament doctrine. They must be faithful to the scriptures. They're not just going there to make people nicer or to encourage people to become more educated or something like that. They need to be faithful to the scriptures and communicating the scriptures to the lost. Only missionaries who have suitable character and are willing to make a life commitment should be sent. They weren't looking for missionaries who would go on short-term trips. Now, admittedly, we have the luxury of short-term trips today where you can hop on a plane and then matter of hours be on a foreign field. They had to get in a boat and travel for a couple of months, frequently, depending on where they were going, but generally they'd get on the boat and be there for 6-8 weeks before they would land in their desired field. But he was looking for people, the society was looking for people who are willing to go with no real hope of retiring in England, so to speak, things like that. Or F there, the mission should be field-directed. He recognized that it was necessary for the people on the ground to have a say in how things were run. They had better perspective on things, and just the simple fact of the distance. You couldn't sit down and Skype with your missionaries and talk through, you know, how should this be going? It was going to be several months. If they asked a question to somebody back in England, it was going to be several months before the director back in England could give them a reply. And so he believed, and the society believed, that the people on the field should be calling the shot, so to speak. Then last there, as much as possible, the mission should be self-supporting with contributions sent as available. Again, it's not like they could make electronic deposits into some bank account for the missionaries on the far-off field. And so it was necessary that they be able to support themselves. If they need more funds from England, it's going to be several months before those funds can really arrive. William Carey, next major character in the beginning of Baptist missions in England. Carey's early life and ministry, he was born near Northampton, England, into a staunchly Anglican household. So he was baptized, sprinkled as an infant, and was raised in a home of a family that was committed to the Anglican Church. His father was a weaver and the village schoolmaster. His father also served as a clerk in the local Anglican Church. Around the age of 14, Carey was apprenticed as a cobbler in the nearby village of Piddington, where in 1775, a fellow cobbler named John Warr led him to faith in Christ. We really don't know much about John Warr. He was a dissenter from the Church of England. We're not even sure that he was a Baptist. We don't really know what his theological convictions were, but he certainly gave the gospel to William Carey, something that he says he had not really heard within the Anglican Church up to this point or in his home. But thankfully, this faithful cobbler gave him the gospel. It would impact many in India in years to come. Shortly after being converted, Carey came to Baptist convictions under the influence of Andrew Fuller. In 1783, he was baptized by John Ryland Jr. in the River Neen. Shortly thereafter, Carey began serving as a lay preacher, working as a cobbler by day and ministering at other times. He read continually and was especially influenced by William Law's series Call to a Devout and Holy Life, Jonathan Edwards' Life and Diary of David Brainerd, and the various voyage publications of James Cook. 1785, Carey began preaching at the Moulton Particular Baptist Church while also teaching in the village school. After he was ordained under John Sutcliffe, he began preaching at Harvey Lane Baptist Church in Leicester. You can see there that one of the churches he preached at regularly still exists. They've changed their name to the Carey Baptist Church. They run a website all about Carey and have all kinds of memorabilia and such related to William Carey. Appears to still be an evangelical, solid church, best I can tell from their website and doctrinal statement and such. Carey became a master of languages, learning Hebrew, Greek, Latin, French, and Dutch in about 7 years. Also studied classical literature, a number of other subjects relevant to future studies. He developed a great burden to reach the lost living in foreign lands. At the Northampton Baptist Association meetings, he would advocate for missions. At one such meeting in 1787, a Baptist pastor asked the men to propose a topic for discussion. So we met together. What should we discuss? What theological issue, practical issue should we discuss? Carey replied, spoke up, said, "We should discuss the need to take the gospel to the heathen." One of the men who was present allegedly said, "Young man, sit down. When God pleases to convert the heathen, he'll do it without your aid or mine." Some of the details about that story has been told numerous times and appears in a bunch of Carey's biographies. There are actually over 50 biographies that have been written of William Carey, and this story appears in many of them. It's often attributed to J.C. Ryland Sr., who incidentally would die in 1792, right as Carey was about to launch out in his actual missionary work. Regardless, this kind of is representative of the way he was received at first. As he pushed for missions within Baptist life, many people were trying to discourage him from this. God is sovereign, and he will convert people when he's good and ready to do so. It's not really a significant issue for you or me. Thankfully, Carey kept pushing. 1789, Carey became pastor of the Harvey Lane Baptist Church in Leicester, where he'd been preaching for a time. 1792, encouraged by Andrew Fuller's theology, he wrote a pamphlet stressing the need for Christians to engage in foreign missions, his inquiry. At a meeting of Baptist pastors, May 30, 1792, Carey preached his famous sermon, "Expect Great Things, Attempt Great Things." It was a sermon based on a passage in Isaiah, probably not really about missions exactly, but talking about enlarging one's tent and spreading out and such. And he talked about God's ability to do great things and the need to move away from the status quo. He again advocated the establishment of a mission society. Some of Carey's listeners that day cautioned delay, but Carey turned to Andrew Fuller and kind of begged him, "Is there nothing again going to be done, sir?" At this point, Andrew Fuller kind of rose to the occasion with a proposal that the next meeting in October, a society be organized for foreign missions. So in October of 1792, a group of Baptist ministers met at Fuller's church in Kettering. After worship, they gathered in the parlor of Mrs. Martha Willis, who was a widow of a former deacon in the church. Here, the Particular Baptist Society for Propagating the Gospel Among the Heathen was formed with Fuller as its first secretary, also known just more commonly as the Baptist Missionary Society. 3 months later, the society chose William Carey and John Thomas as its first missionaries to India. They took up their first offering in a little snuff box. Didn't know about the dangers of tobacco in those days. In April 1793, the Carey family and John Thomas set sail for India aboard the Danish ship, the Crown Princess Maria. At this point, Dorothy Carey was expecting their fourth son. She actually didn't want to go to the mission field. The ship got delayed for a time. She originally wasn't going to go. She said she was going to stay in England. She went back and forth. While the ship was stuck at a nearby port, they had left and was stuck in a port off the coast of England. She gave birth and ended up changing her mind. People kept talking to her, and someone offered to go with her. And anyway, she ended up going. It would be nothing, unfortunately, but a disaster. Within the sovereignty of God, God gave William Carey a wife, But she was not, she had no heart for missions, apparently, and as time would go on, she would become increasingly difficult on the mission field. After a couple of delays, they landed in Calcutta, India, in November of 1793. At that point, Carey and Thomas soon established their headquarters in Madnabadi, just a little west of Calcutta, where Carey worked at an indigo plant while learning Bengali, the local language. Carey actually managed the indigo plant for about 6 years. 1794, so about a year after they had been there, Carey's five-year-old son, Peter, died from dysentery, and in the wake of that loss, his wife, Dorothy, became increasingly depressed and unstable, and she would really be quite a burden. She really wasn't able to go out in public very much, and when she did, she would do things that were really problematic for the mission's effort. She would die in 1807, and Carey would end up remarrying later, but very difficult. It would be nice to say they were this, you know, model missionary couple going out to the field. Unfortunately, it just wasn't the case. In 1797, Carey completed the first draft of his Bengali translation of the New Testament. In the years that followed, he went on to break new ground by his service in India. In addition to his teaching and preaching duties, he established schools and medical services, church planting. He also supervised and edited translations of the Bible into approximately 36 languages, and produced a Bengali-English lexicon and several grammars. Sometimes people talk about Carey knowing dozens of languages as if, like, he did all this translation work himself. Much as translation work is done on the field today, he had a lot of locals working with him, and he kind of supervised, directed what they were doing, proofread, talked through how to translate various passages. But he wasn't actually fluent in 36 languages, though he was obviously a master of languages, extremely capable. He wasn't actually doing all this work himself. As William Cathcart summarized, his encyclopedia said, in 30 years, Carey and his brethren rendered the Word of God accessible to one-third of the world. Page 6, in 1800, the Careys moved to Serampore, where they were soon joined by fellow missionaries Joshua Marshman and William Ward. John Thomas, who had originally gone with, also created problems for them on the mission field. He ran up debts and misspent some money and things like that. He died in the year 1800 or 1801. It's a little unclear. And these other men joined Carey right about this same time. Joshua Marshman was primarily an educator. He established a boarding school in Serampore. William Ward was primarily a printer. With all these translations of the scriptures being produced, they needed to be able to distribute them. And William Ward really came from England for the purpose of distributing the scriptures and other books that would be published. Shortly after arriving in Serampore, Carey was able to baptize their first Hindu convert, an Indian carpenter named Krishna Pal. Krishna Pal would be, he would be a very pleasant story, certainly fruit that remained. He would be very committed to the church. He would actually end up writing a number of hymns in the local languages and was very much a faithful believer until he died in 1822. In time, Carey, Marshman, and Ward would come to be known as the Serampore Trio, or the Triumvirate. Together, they produced the Serampore form of agreement. William Ward was probably the penman for that, but certainly with input from the three, and about a half dozen other missionaries would end up signing on to that in 1805. And they laid out kind of their principles of missionary work. How should the work be done here on the field? Kind of what are our goals? They laid out 11 goals. And I have them summarized here as well as quotes, which I won't read from the document itself. One of their first goals or principles was to set an infinite value on men's souls, to recognize that the souls of men are of great value. Our great aim is to see them saved. Second there, to acquaint ourselves with the snares which hold the minds of people, things that local customs, worldview issues that keep people from hearing the gospel clearly, things that would make Christianity in some ways repulsive, not because of the gospel, but because of social differences. So false religions, things that the heathen believed, the lost believed, that prevented them from hearing the gospel. Third there, to abstain from whatever deepens India's prejudice against the gospel, closely related to that, abstain from things such as eating certain meats. They made it an aim to be very kind to animals, especially in front of the Hindus, because of their beliefs about reincarnation and such. And so they curtailed their behavior, not that they were unkind to animals, but they behaved in certain ways, were careful to behave in certain ways around Hindus, lest they give unnecessary offense. Fourth, they're to watch for every chance of doing the people good, every opportunity to engage in ministry, not to become lax, not to become comfortable, but to engage in opportunities as they're given. Fifth, they're to preach Christ crucified as the grand means of conversion, looking back to the example of Paul. They're to esteem and treat Indians always as our equals, recognizing that if India is going to be reached with the gospel, it's going to need to be Indians who bring the gospel. Englishmen simply aren't able to bring the gospel to all of India. It's going to be locals who are equipped and know the language who are going to bring the gospel to India. G there on page 7, to guard and build up the souls that may be gathered, discipleship and such, preaching and teaching those who have been converted. H, to cultivate the spiritual gifts, ever pressing upon them their missionary obligation, since only Indians can win India for Christ. So recognizing that they are capable, that God gifts his people, regardless of where they're born, and further encouraging them to engage in missions themselves. Letter I there, to labor unceasingly in Bible translation. J, to be instant in the nurture of personal religion. And last, to give ourselves without reserve to the cause, not counting even the clothes we wear our own. To be willing to give up their lives, their goods, their time for the sake of the gospel. Page 8 carries lasting impact on missions. Stephen Neal, in his kind of classic book on the history of Christian missions, summarizes Carey's impact this way. Said books written in English have frequently spoken of William Carey as the father of modern missions and of the work he brought into being as the first Protestant mission of modern times. This is a misunderstanding. Carey stood and was conscious of standing in a noble succession as the heir of many pioneers in the past. Yet his work does represent a turning point. It marks the entry of the English-speaking world on a large scale into the missionary enterprise. And it has been the English-speaking world which has provided four-fifths of the non-Roman missionaries from the day of Carey up until the present time. So this is really the beginning of English-language missions that really begins with Carey. Though he recognizes believers before have engaged in missions, he did look to the Moravians for examples as well. But this is the beginning of English involvement in missions, and as Neil says, about 80% of Protestant missionaries from Carey's day to the present have come from English-speaking places. I'm going to skip over Samuel Pierce here for the sake of time, a faithful pastor who supported missions and is kind of representative of the need for faithful pastors to send and supply and certainly encourage others to pray for missionary efforts. So moving down the page 8 there, I'm going to talk about a couple of early British missionaries from other denominations. Carey and Fuller, committed particular Baptists. Here are a few people who were not Baptists. Henry Martin was an Anglican in the Church of England. He was born in Cornwall, England. He was raised in the home of a wealthy merchant who provided for his son's education. After completing grammar school, he attended Cambridge University, where he received several honors for his work in the field of mathematics. He was a very bright young man. During his youth and early college days, Martin largely lived a life of rebellion against God. Then one evening in the fall of 1802, he happened to hear a lecture by an evangelical Anglican named Charles Simeon, in which Simeon described the work of William Carey and his associates over in India. A short time later, Martin also read Jonathan Edwards' account of David Brainerd's life and ministry. These examples of Carey and Brainerd motivated Martin to pursue a life of missionary work, realized that perfunctory attendance at church and just going through the motions of Christianity was not true religion. As he saw the sacrifice of these men, he recognized that these men had been changed and had a desire to serve the Lord, kind of not counting the cost. After becoming an Anglican priest, Martin signed on with the East India Company as a chaplain and headed to India in 1805. In India, Martin met William Carey who helped them get started in translation work. Martin was responsible for ministering to the English employees and families of the East India Company, but in addition to that work, he also took many opportunities to travel to various English military outposts where he would preach to the Indian people. With the prompting of Carey, Martin started schools among the native people and translated the New Testament into Arabic, Persian, and Urdu, the three main languages of the Muslim world at that time. Although he was in poor health, Martin sailed to Persia, or what we would think of as Iran, to engage in further translation work with the hope of seeing his health improve in a better climate. There in Iran, Martin penned several tracts for Muslims and continued editing his translations of the New Testament. After spending about 2 years in Iran, he attempted to return to England over land. It's a long distance in the day. But he died along the way in Turkey at the age of just 31. His example of sacrificial labor, especially as reflected in the journal he left behind, inspired a number of other young people to pursue missionary work. Here was a very wealthy young man, well-equipped, well-educated, would have had a very productive and capable and very comfortable life in England. And yet here he goes and dies at the age of 31 on the missionary, on the foreign field because of the gospel. And many people read about that and realized, you know, I have had fewer opportunities. If he's willing to go, I should be willing as well. Yeah, Pierre.
Is that journal a published work?
It is, yeah. I don't have the title in here, but it's something like just the journals of Henry Martin. So he interacted with Carey. It's interesting, never is converted to Baptist principles. That would be unlike the Judsons. Some of you probably know the story of Adoniram and Ann Judson. Leave New England as congregational missionaries. Along the way, realize they're going to meet William Carey, and so the ship's pool is not working, the game room is shut down. They really have nothing to do on the ship but study the scriptures. And so they begin to focus on infant baptism and trying to argue for infant baptism. Trying to develop their arguments in preparation for meeting India and become convinced that the Bible doesn't teach infant baptism. It teaches believers' baptism. Shortly after they arrive in India, they were baptized by Carey and they have to resign their mission board, and it was kind of a mess, but here they are in the foreign field and they are no longer congregationalists, sent by a board that was predominantly congregational. So it was kind of an interesting transition. Anyway, Henry Martin never was converted to Baptist principles, but certainly preached the gospel. Next man, Robert Morrison, was a Presbyterian missionary born in Morpeth, England. He was the youngest of eight children, born to a Scottish father and an English mother. He's kind of the opposite of Henry Martin. He's born to a very poor family. His father was just a farmhand when he was born and really did not have the opportunities that a man like Henry Martin had. Morrison was raised within the Church of Scotland, basically Presbyterian, and was taught the Westminster Shorter Catechism from an early age. In 1803, he entered the Hoxton Academy in London, which was a dissenting college. The following year, he was accepted as a missionary candidate by the London Missionary Society, which at this point, this was a largely congregational kind of organization, though they did send some others. Obviously, Morrison as a Presbyterian. Morrison studied Chinese with a scholar in London for a time, also studied medicine in preparation for heading to China. January 1807, Morrison finally set sail on an American vessel, headed to China by way of the U.S. About 9 months later, in September of 1807, he arrived in Canton, China, a major city today. That city, which I won't attempt to pronounce, has something like 25 million people today. So a major center. Although he had not traveled to China under the auspices of the East India Company, his work in China was almost immediately hindered by the East India Company, which prohibited evangelistic outreach by Englishmen living in the Far East. Morrison was forced to work around such problems. As Ruth Tucker explains, in spite of the restrictions placed on him, Morrison was able to secure language tutors and soon after began compiling a dictionary and secretly translating the Bible. So impressed were the East India Company officials with his dictionary that they offered him a position as a translator. He was convinced that such a move was the only way he would come to terms with the company. I mentioned before that the East India Company both enabled missionaries to go to certain places, but at times hindered them, wanted to prevent them from doing anything that would hinder their efforts at trade. and might stir up the population, cause a riot within territory under English military control, things like that. Yeah?
A question in that realm. Reading, seems to me I've seen the impression from later times in history that missionaries were looked as being a part of the problem of colonialism, but yet
right.
what you suggested here is they were same time and period, but actually they were not tools of the East India Company to colonize.
Same time and place in many cases as the British flag and British imperialistic efforts. For the most part, the missionaries, I mean, they're bringing the gospel from a land which is considered to be Christian, India, or England, going to areas that are considered to be non-Christian. So many did see them as bringing the Englishman's religion, and I'm converting to the English religion. Certainly people saw it that way. And historians looking back, some of you probably have seen books about post-colonialism and all that, you know, trying to... books looking back certainly do... Many of them, particularly secular works, see them as, you know, almost locked arms with the East India Company. It was more complicated than that. They certainly butted heads with the East India Company. Sometimes they worked for the East India Company. Again, they needed support on the field, and sometimes it was a means of kind of tent making on the field. But I wouldn't see them as primarily a tool of English colonialism, though they were accused of that. After all, they're speaking English. They're learning the local languages, but they're speaking English and they're preaching a religion that is deemed to be kind of the white man's religion, the English religion. Bottom of page 9, about the same time, Morrison married the daughter of an English doctor who was then living in China. Unfortunately, this marriage was as well not a real happy one. At this point, women were not allowed to live in the city of Canton. I'm not sure how this worked, but at least English women weren't able to live there, and so Morrison's wife actually lived in another city some 90 miles away, and the two were separated for months at a time. This was rather difficult. The upside to it was he was free from, he had a lot of time to work on translation work, was not, Paul talks about the single person being able to give their time, full time, to the gospel and such, and Morrison was able to devote his time to the missionary labor, but it was not an ideal situation, I think we'd say, from our perspective. Amidst his various familial challenges in 1814, Morrison baptized his first Chinese convert. In his roughly 27 years in China, he'd only see about 10 Chinese converts. Yet he set an example and certainly established a beachhead for missionary work on the coast of China. In 1815, Mary and their two children returned to England, and for 6 years, Robert and Mary actually lived thousands of miles apart as they were back in England. In 1821, Mary and the children returned to China to visit their husband and father, and during the summer of 1821, Mary died rather unexpectedly. Morrison then sent his two children back to England to be raised by believers there. They didn't have missionary prayer cards then, and they would have been difficult in some of these cases just because of the family situations. About the same time, Morrison completed his translation of the Bible into Chinese. In 1824, Morrison took his first and only furlough back to England, where his two children were then living. Upon arriving back in England, Morrison found himself to be something of a celebrity among nonconformist Christians. He was flooded with invitations to speak, and in accepting many of these, he decided to emphasize the need for many more missionaries to head to China and other needy fields. While in England, he remarried a woman named Eliza Armstrong, 1825 and 1826. They, along with his two children, returned to China. Back in China, Morrison continued his kind of clandestine evangelism as translation work, which was now primarily focused on extra-biblical Christian literature. During the late 1820s and early 30s, the Morrisons had five more children. 1832, Elizabeth and their seven children returned to England, and by this point, Morrison's own health was failing. He died in 1834 at the age of 52, just 2 months after William Carey died over in India. So, unfortunately, Robert Morrison goes and is certainly a great example, and even as he travels back to England, preaches the needs, impresses upon Englishmen the need for the gospel to be brought to places like China, but sees only about 10 converts for almost 3 decades worth of labor in a far-off land. Hudson Taylor would kind of be, his ministry experience would be rather different. Hudson Taylor was raised as a Methodist, but would later join a Baptist church in London at some point toward the end of his life, but was kind of non-denominational, was not very focused on denominational distinctives. Born in Barnsley, England, Hudson Taylor was raised in a family that encouraged him to look toward the mission field. His father was a pharmacist, a lay preacher within the Methodist church. During his early teen years, Taylor was uninterested in spiritual things, but at the age of 17, he was converted and soon committed himself to going to China as a missionary. In preparation for a life of missionary labor in China, the young Hudson Taylor began studying the Gospel of Luke in Chinese, also studied medicine, with a view to using medicine as a means of building relationships in China. In 1853, some important political changes took place in China, and it seemed to create a more open door for missionary work. At this point, Taylor interrupted his medical studies and headed to China under the short-lived China Evangelization Society. Poor health, along with differences with the Mission Society, caused Taylor to return to England in 1860, but during his initial term in China, Taylor met his first wife and ministry companion, Maria Dyer. Maria's parents had actually been missionaries in China, but they were both had passed away by the time he met her. Back in England, Taylor continued his medical studies and his translation work. In 1865, he wrote a book titled China's Spiritual Need and Claims. Finding no society willing to sponsor him, in 1865, Taylor established the China Inland Mission. And the following year, the Taylors, along with more than a dozen others, traveled to China. One of the reasons other mission societies weren't willing to support the Taylors or bring them on as missionaries had to do with Hudson Taylor's decision to adopt Chinese dress during his first term. During his short time in China, he decided to take on the neutral customs, the dress, the hairstyle, things like that of the Chinese people in order to further blend in with them. He was not trying to establish an English culture within China, was very much willing to adapt to their culture. And many back in England saw that as somehow inappropriate. We heard last night about issues of conscience. Some had conscience issues with this. Somehow this was paganism. This was related to what these pagan people, the way they dress, the way they look, and things like that. And so people back in England were hesitant to support some, at least the organizations, were hesitant to support Hudson Taylor. Taylor's China Inland Mission was rather unusual. As Ruth Tucker explains, the China Inland Mission was a unique missionary society molded around the experiences and personality of Hudson Taylor. It was an independent mission that appealed largely to the working classes. Taylor knew that China would never be evangelized if he had to rely on educated, ordained ministers to go. So he sought men and women among England's massive laboring classes. By appealing to this segment, he avoided competition with other mission boards, thus maximizing the missionary effort in China. His experience with the CES confirmed the need to establish the headquarters for the mission in China, where he could retain control. As to finances and personal support, the CIM missionaries were offered no set salary, but rather were to depend entirely on God to rely on God for their needs. To avoid even the appearance of relying on human resources, offerings, and other forms of direct appeals for money were strictly taboo. And so Hudson Taylor, in many ways, adopted different methods than those being used by Baptists and Presbyterians and others in India, in China, and other fields of the world. Taylor's missionary zeal was matched by his remarkable organizational skills and almost unprecedented sense of boldness. He was willing to try unusual things, such as adopting Chinese dress and not raising support, that few other Europeans would really consider. These qualities led to unusually fruitful results. Near the end of his ministry, the China Inland Mission oversaw about 825 European missionaries and about 500 Chinese workers serving in 18 different provinces throughout China. By the late 1890s, these missionaries had seen some 25,000 Chinese converted to Christ. One perhaps weakness of this missionary effort was they tended to emphasize evangelism, sometimes at the expense of actual church planting, establishing, staying in an area, teaching people, and establishing a solid church, but certainly did bring the gospel to many major cities along the eastern side of China and inland some, and certainly many were genuinely converted. These remarkable ministry results were unfortunately combined with some rather stunning personal losses. During his 35 years in China, Taylor lost 2 wives and 4 of his 8 children to disease. 4 of their 8 children died before the age of 10, a few of them in early infancy. His ministry ended on a rather sad note as ill health combined with seeing 79 colleagues and children killed in the Boxer Rebellion of 1900, and that would lead to his retirement that year. Still remarkably fruitful ministry in a far-off land using unusual methods. Right, a few concluding thoughts, looking back over the labor of these various men from different backgrounds, even different denominations, with varying degrees of visible fruit, at least. As one considers the work of God accomplished through British missionaries during the great century, 3 main themes seem to stand out. On page 12, first, during the great century, the leading missionaries were marked by strong biblical and theological convictions. They preached the scriptures, they translated them into the local languages, they worked to ground new believers in the basics of the faith, and they combined great effort with a solemn trust in the sovereignty of God. For example, in 1805, the Serampore missionaries confessed, "We are sure that only those who are ordained to eternal life will believe, and that God alone can add to the church such as shall be saved. Nevertheless, we cannot but observe with admiration that Paul, the great champion of the glorious doctrines of free and sovereign grace, was the most conspicuous for his personal zeal in the work of persuading men to be reconciled to God." You may recall, and I mentioned earlier, men like Fuller and Carey were particular Baptists. They were thoroughgoing Calvinists, certainly believed in the sovereignty of God, were committed to the great truths of God's work in salvation, and they were Orthodox. They also very active, certainly very active in bringing the gospel to the lost. So strong biblical and theological convictions, certainly related to the sovereignty of God, faithfulness. During the great century, many missionaries demonstrated remarkable perseverance as they labored through difficulties and disappointing setbacks. William Carey worked in India for 7 years before seeing his first convert. For 30 years, he maintained a daily routine that involved poring over translation work. Near the end of his life, as Carey perceived that some intended to write the story of his life and ministry, Carey said this. He's writing to a nephew of his who would actually write the very first biography of William Carey. He wrote to his nephew and said, "If after my removal anyone should think it worth his while to write my life, I will give you a criterion by which you may judge its correctness. If he gives me the credit for being a plotter, he will describe me justly. Anything beyond this will be too much. I can plod, I can persevere in any definite pursuit. To this I owe everything." Certainly wasn't saying, "I can do this and, you know, I don't have God's help." But in this case, he's saying, basically, "I've just plotted. I haven't done anything spectacular, anything remarkable. I've just done what God put before me, and day after day engaged in translation work especially." Third there, during the great century, many missionaries made enormous sacrifices as they struggled with sickness and lost spouses, children, and co-workers to early graves. Perhaps you mentioned that I kept mentioning loss of a spouse, loss of a child, some of the difficulties that these men went through, and their wives, certainly. But the men I was talking about, as they lost spouses, children, co-workers, in the case of Hudson Taylor, certainly many co-workers, it simply wasn't an easy field that they went to. For example, just a year after arriving in India, Carey wrote this in his journal. I've taken this from a couple different sections of his journal written over the course of just about a month. He said, "During this time, late 1794, I've had a heavy and long affliction, having been taken with a violent fever. One of the paroxysms continued for 26 hours without intermission. God recovered me, but in about, that should be 10 days, I relapsed again. And the fever was attended with a violent vomiting and dysentery. And even now I am very ill. On the last of these days, it pleased God to remove by death my youngest child, but one, second youngest child, a fine, engaging boy of rather more than 5 years of age. He had been seized with a fever and after recovering, but relapsed, and a violent dysentery carried him off. on the same day we were obliged to bury him, which was an exceedingly difficult thing. I could induce no person to make a coffin and conclude that I and my wife would have to do it ourselves. Two lowly servants were finally found who would help. Most people didn't want to, they typically burned the body, the Indians did, and so most didn't want to be involved in anything to do with a burying a body. Anyway, they find a couple of servants who help them carry the corpse and secure the grave from the jackals. Sorry, typo there. Secure the grave from the jackals. And this is really the beginning of the end for Mrs. Carey. At this point, she really takes a turn for the worse. She had not been interested in the mission work prior to this. After the loss of this child, things went downhill further. A lot has changed since the great century of Christian missions. They traveled in wooden ships, big tubs basically with sails and such. Today we get in an aluminum can and fly through the air. Electronic communication. Now missionaries, most of them, can even pick up a phone and talk to people here in the States, see their faces, hear their voices. I'm not saying that there's no sacrifice, but things have changed. Some of the things that we've take for granted now. Certainly the decline of British imperialism, as the British flag is not planted all around the globe, particularly in places like India, Australia, China. But some things haven't changed. And I think these three themes are still very relevant to missions. Strong biblical and theological convictions. Perseverance. Certainly mission work has changed in some regards, but perseverance to stay in a place that is difficult and sometimes lonely is still needed on the mission field today. Enormous sacrifice. The kinds of sacrifices may have changed to some degree, but people still need to be willing to sacrifice, to give up the American dream in order to go to a field and a place that some might not consider to be very attractive in order to bring the gospel to the lost.